medicine of East Asia is based on a science that does not hold itself separate from the phenomena that it seeks to understand. Our medicine did not grow out of petri dish experimentation or double-blind studies. It arose from observing nature and our part in it. East Asian medicine evolves not from the examination of dead structures, but rather from living systems with their complex, mutually entangled interactions. Welcome to Cheological. I'm Michael Max, the host of this podcast that goes in-depth on issues pertinent to practitioners and students of East Asian medicine. Dialogue and discussion have always been elemental to Chinese and other East Asian medicines. Listen in to these conversations with experienced practitioners that go deep into how this ancient medicine is alive and unfolding in the modern clinic. These conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Worried that an EMR is too complex for you? Jane has friendly and knowledgeable support. Meiwei Herbs is celebrating the 55th year of their family business. You're invited to make use of their vast library of resources. Are you concerned about the health of Mother Earth? AccuFast Needles is doing something about that. You can too. And later in the show, Ancestral Sturman offers up a sinew treatment, and the folks at Blue Poppy have something special to share as well. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Cheological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast.
Hi folks, I'm Yvonne Lau, president of Meiwei Herbs. Our family business turns 55 this year, and we wouldn't have gotten this far without the love and support of our community. We're truly grateful and promise you that we'll continue to work hard to support you and your practice. Please visit Meiwei.com to find the perfect Pumsar brand formula or formulate your own in our dispensary. Our site also has lots of articles, videos, and herbal recipes for you to explore. And tune into our podcast, Chinese Medicine Matters, for insightful discussions on all things TCM. Learn about treatment strategies and powerful herbal remedies. As we welcome the month of May, our focus is on women's health. Our newsletter articles and podcast episodes this month will highlight different aspects and unique challenges women face, so subscribe or tune in. And if you're a practitioner, get a discount on our women's health formulas this month. Just visit Meiwei.com. This season and every season, trust Meiwei Herbs for your health and wellness needs. And thank you for supporting Real Chinese Medicine.
I love how technology can help to automate my office, and I want to share with you my favorite tool for doing so, Jane. Jane is a clinic management software in EMR with a human touch. Whether you're switching your software or going paperless for the first time, the Jane team knows that the onboarding process can feel a little overwhelming. That's why with Jane, you don't just get software, you get a whole team. Included in every Jane subscription is their award-winning customer support available by phone, email, and chat whenever you need it, even Saturdays. You can also book a free account setup consultation to review your account and ensure you feel confident about going live. If you're interested in making the switch to Jane, head to jane.app/switch to book a one-on-one demo with a member of their support team. And be sure to mention the code CHEOLOGICAL at the time of sign up for a one-month grace period on your new Jane account. I don't know about you, but sometimes I take a step back and marvel at my acupuncture needles. I mean, they're the world's simplest medical tool. A sharpened wire and a handle. That's it. And with this simple tool, hundreds of health conditions can be resolved. I love it. What I didn't love was the amount of packaging waste I generated at the end of the day. But that has now changed too. Ever since I switched to AccuFast Earth-Friendly Needles, I reduced my packaging waste by 90%. Not only are they a great needle, but the folks at AccuFast plant a tree for every two boxes of needles I use in the clinic. By switching to AccuFast Needles, you'll be helping patients, planting trees, and joining a community of practitioners changing the world. Like our simple needle, being a part of the solution, it's simple too. Visit AccuFastNeedles.com/cheological to learn how. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Cheological. My guest today is Henry McCann. Henry is the author of two books, one on Dongshi acupuncture, which is going to be the subject of our show today, and another one on bloodletting, which actually has a lot to do with the Dongshi acupuncture. It's part of that tradition as well. He teaches all over the United States, and in particular at PCOM in New York City. He also teaches at a couple of doctorate programs, one in Portland, the other one in the Bay Area, and also travels internationally to teach people about Dong-style acupuncture. So I'm very excited to have him on the show today, and we're going to get deep and geeky into this particular aspect and tradition of acupuncture. Henry, welcome to Cheological.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'm curious, and I often ask this of people at the beginning, how did you find your way into this particular aspect of acupuncture? I mean, there's so many different parts of our tradition. What drew you to the Dong style?
You know, to some extent, I think a lot of us sort of fall into places part by dumb luck, if you don't like dumb luck and whatever sort of resonance maybe we have in for whatever reason, you know, I had, without really knowing it, been exposed to some of the ideas in Dong's acupuncture from one of my early teachers. I initially trained at the New England School of Acupuncture, and one of our early teachers was a Taiwanese acupuncturist. And you know, if you're probably most of your listeners know, but if they don't know, Master Dong spent the last part of his life living and practicing in Taiwan. So his writings and his teachings were mostly first disseminated through other Taiwanese acupuncturists, because he never taught outside. He never taught in mainland China when he was a younger person before he left for Taiwan after the war in the middle of the 20th century. And so when I was in school, I was introduced to some of the principles that we talk about quite a bit in terms of channel relationships and ways of looking at connecting channels, even without it being sort of described as being from a Dong perspective. So from very early on, I was predisposed to sort of looking at acupuncture a certain way. And then it was really just a series of coincidences, perhaps, you know, quite a long time ago, I found Miriam Lee's book. And when I first read it, I thought to myself, how could I have gone through a professional acupuncture training program and all these other points and all these other traditions exist, and yet I had never heard about them, right? And I was fortunate enough to go through a training program where TCM was not the only method of treatment that was taught. You know, the New England School of Acupuncture was renowned for its very detailed and in-depth program in Japanese acupuncture systems. So very early on, I was predisposed to be to favor, at least to some extent, non-TCM systems and being comfortable with working within more than one system at the same time.
Yeah, it's kind of like being bilingual.
Yes, absolutely, without a doubt. It definitely is. And, you know, it's something that for me was really foundational in that I was taught to look at acupuncture from a number of different perspectives and not just, you know, taught through, for example, just a quick CEU class. You know, the Japanese acupuncture was an integral part of the training at the New England School. Mm-hmm. And so after reading Miriam Lee's book, I was frustrated that there could be all this information out there that yet I had never heard of, that wasn't really being talked about much. And so that sent me it was the same with my background in bloodletting. You know, all these teachers talked about bloodletting, how important it was, how great it was. And yet in my own training, I had maybe half of one technique class in 3+ years of training. And so how could it be such an important thing, but we spend so little time on it?
Right. It's almost like a little tease. It's like, here's something
exactly
you should know about it. And well, now what?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that sort of led my exploration and then, you know, my later drive to seek out whatever teachers I could seek out over the years to eventually start getting whatever texts I could out of Taiwan and China, and just to really sort of immerse myself in the system that way. And so that was my initial sort of foray into it.
Great. We're going to get into some of that detail here of the Dong system. But before we do, because, you know, so many people listening to this show, maybe all they've been exposed to is the TCM, the textbook, the stuff that we all need to learn because there's a test that we have to pass. And there's plenty of good stuff in the TCM. It's not like it's wrong. It's just one part of the tradition. And yet, it seems so often whatever we learn first, it kind of sticks, and it's often hard to shift and go beyond our initial impressions or our initial learnings. So before we get into learning some things about the Dong system, what would you say are some key elements or some key things that we probably have to unlearn if we're going to really jump into the Dong Xi system and be able to learn something from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and it's a really sort of... It's an important thing that you just identified, in that our early training oftentimes, as a teacher myself, I hope that our early training sets the stage for later learning. But the truth is, for many people, the early training is basically where it starts and where it ends. And, you know, I want to be clear in saying that I don't think that TCM, for example, as a systems approach to acupuncture in any way is bad. You know, I think that every way of looking at it has potential pluses and negatives. And I think TCM is some of the best acupuncturists I've ever seen in practice, in terms of their ability to really treat disease effectively, have been TCM practitioners. And so, you know, I agree with you that TCM is important for many reasons. One of the things I like about TCM is that it tends to, in its theoretical model, sample a number of other systems or a wide variety of, for example, diagnostic paradigms, ways of looking at channels, ways of looking at Zangfu, et cetera. So I think it gives people a fantastic grounding. You know, so to some extent, I would say that there's really nothing we need to unlearn. We just basically need to sort of train ourselves to look at being able to analyze the material that's already there, perhaps from different angles and perhaps in a more in-depth way than is given in the basic training. You know, the basic textbooks are great, but I think we need to keep in mind that they're just basic textbooks. And they're there to give us a beginning foundation in material from which we can springboard into a deeper, hopefully, understanding of what we're doing therapeutically. You know, the only thing I would say perhaps that needs to be unlearned is that, in my opinion, acupuncture and herbal medicine they don't exactly work 100% the same. There are different mechanisms of action. There are different ways of accessing the body. And for better or for worse, TCM, because of the emphasis on herbal medicine in mainland China today, in my opinion, tends to be more herb-focused. So when people are learning herbal medicine, I think TCM serves them better than when they're learning acupuncture as a standalone therapy. So perhaps I think the big thing we need to unlearn is that acupuncture points are not necessarily herbs, and we can't necessarily see them as such, right?
Right. That's a great distinction. Acupuncture points are not herbs.
Right. They're not herbs. I mean, whenever I teach, there are a couple of key examples that I give, and you know, like one of the examples I give is I ask people like what kidney 2 does, you know, so what does the main function of Rangguo, of kidney 2? And all over the world, whenever I've asked this question, all the TCM students always say it clears vacuity fire, clears empty heat, something like that, right? Which, yes, it does. But if we go back and look at the traditional list of indications for that point, we see included, for example, conditions like fifth watch diarrhea, right? Which last time I checked doesn't really come from a kidney yin insufficiency. It comes from some sort of problem in the yang and the heating aspect of the kidney. So we can see that kidney 2 has some sort of regulating effect on the kidney channel and its relationship to fire phase, because it's an ink spring point, it's a fire point. So it can go both ways, right? It doesn't only have to treat a problem of a yin insufficiency. It can regulate the kidney relationship with fire. And there isn't really a single herb, for example, that warms the kidney yang as well as clears vacuity heat at the same time, right?
Right.
So it's so to some extent, it's just different. When putting a needle in kidney two is not like giving someone an herbal formula or even a single herb. So I think that perhaps is, and it's not only for learning Dong's acupuncture. I think to really be a good acupuncturist, I think that's one of the first things we need to sort of not necessarily unlearn, but perhaps evaluate on a little bit deeper level, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does make sense. Well, and I like the way that you point out is the Ying spring point. It's the fire point on the kidney channel. And so whenever you're thinking about kidney and fire issues or even water issues to some degree, right, because fire and water have that kind of a relationship, you can begin to look into these kind of resonances.
This yes.
And this is one of the things I love about the Dongshi acupuncture is it's so much based on resonance.
Right. And that word resonance to me is very important, right? Because this is, in my opinion, you know, at PCOM in New York City, I teach classical texts. And, you know, sometimes I think to myself when I'm teaching books like the Neijing in particular, maybe not the Nanjing, but the Neijing definitely, I think to myself, is this a book of medicine that talks about cosmology? And the cosmological discussion is all about this idea of resonance, right? Mm-hmm. Like how we as humans resonate with the natural world, how that really impacts us, you know, sort of in our interaction with others, interaction with the weather, interaction with the natural world, or our interaction sort of within ourselves, right? The organ interaction with other organs, points with channels, et cetera, right? So it's all about this idea of resonance. And so sometimes I think maybe books like the Neijing really are medical books about cosmology and resonance. But sometimes I think, you know, they're probably really first and foremost books about cosmology and resonance. And oh, by the way, here's how we apply that to medicine, because this is really how it all works.
Well, given the way that Chinese thinking seems to work, it's both and.
Yeah, yeah, I totally. No, I completely agree with you on that one, without a doubt. So
yeah. Okay. So I've studied a little bit of the Dongshi acupuncture, right, through the books. And even I spent a little time with a practitioner when I lived in Taiwan, which was interesting because it was literally a bloody mess in there.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Oh, my God. This guy would, he would often bleed the back and then stick cups on there with continuous suction. It was a bloodborne pathogen nightmare in there, but you know, really interesting. And so one of the things that to me is so interesting, again, we're looking at resonance, we're looking at the various taijis that we can see the body through. And there's a number of ways of imaging the body through the various taijis. It's a great idea. And I've found for myself in my own clinical practice, sometimes I get confused. It's like, which taiji am I working with? And actually, when should I be working with which one? Now, there are certain times you want to use the greater taiji, or there are certain times you want to use the smaller ones. Are there any guidelines or ways of thinking about how do we start to orient ourselves to looking at these particular resonances?
I mean, this is a really good question. And, you know, first, before I even sort of delve into that question, I want to be clear that when Master Dong himself taught in Taiwan, he really didn't talk much theory, right? And so he was a very traditional sort of teacher in that you really sort of followed him, watched what he did, and, you know, he would admonish people to sort of think about it for themselves. So all of theory that we have, that we talk about, comes from the sort of the thoughtful analysis by his students and his students' students, right? So there are a number of different ways to look at Dong's system, because Master Dong himself never really he gave us hints, and I think some of the hints are embedded within the system itself, but he never came out in his own books that he wrote. Basically, they were just texts where it said, here's the point's location, here's what it treats, and that's it.
Right? It's very Shanghan Lunish, isn't it?
Yeah, it very much is. Honestly, it very much is. And we'll go into that, that idea of how we just see medicine as an endeavor. But, you know, even before that, so when we're looking at the theory associated with Dong's acupuncture, there are lots of different ways of doing it. And, you know, to some extent, that's fine, because even in our classical texts, there are lots of different approaches where we can look at the same sort of material through different lenses. So the lens that I choose to look at things is this lens of these of channel connections, of imaging resonances, right? Because this, for me, it makes sense. And I think when I'm teaching it to other people, it makes it easier for people to sort of grasp, right? So then, so that's the first piece of the disclaimer, I guess. The question that you brought up of what image or what way of looking at it is best, or, you know, which one are we triggering? To some extent, one of the answers, I think, is that they're all different ways. There are lots of different ways that the body can be mapped out onto itself. There are different sort of connections in the body, how channels connect to other channels, how channels connect to the Zhang organs, et cetera. To some extent, there's not one best way of looking at things. So when we're really trying to learn the system, in my opinion, there are two basic angles we need to look at. One of the basic angles is, what are all of the theoretical connections that we see going on that we can describe? For example, how does this one channel connect to that channel, or how does the hand connect to the head, or how does the foot connect to the hand or the head? That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is simply looking at what the points have been used traditionally to treat, right? So not every point treats everything equally, right? And so we know, even from TCM, there are certain points that I would call heavy hitters, mm-hmm. that really sort of have a wide-ranging effect, both in terms of symptom management as well as Zhangfu regulation, and some that are maybe only really for symptomatic management. They don't have wide-ranging regulatory effects, right? So when we're looking at the theory, it's not that we can't also, or it's not that we can get away with only looking at the theory of what point maps to this area of the body without also looking at what these points were traditionally used for at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the reason I teach the theory is so that we have a better understanding of why the points are doing what they're doing. So the theory is a way to help us understand and keep the points in our head at any one given time or another.
Mm-hmm. It kind of orients us.
It does, right. So when we're looking at, you know, what image am I trying to trigger, to some extent, the real answer is, what point am I using and why am I using that point? Or why is this point, say, better for digestive problems than this other point for digestive problems? Or why is this point better for pain management than this other point for pain management in this part of the body? So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, I do believe that the more ways we can get a point to resonate with a certain area of the body or condition, the stronger that resonance is. So if I can get to take a TCM point, for example, right? So let's look at a point like Zhusanli, like stomach 36.
Classic.
Of course.
And super heavy hitter, right? Yeah.
And it's a heavy hitter because there's so many different ways of resonating with the things that it treats. So just looking at digestive problems in both. So for example, we talk about different ways of mapping points onto the body. Stomach 36 can be mapped into the area of the spleen stomach through all the different sort of image resonances that we teach, or that I teach, right? So looking at what I call the large taiji, the medium taiji, and the small taiji, all of them can map stomach 36 to the digestive organs. Stomach 36 is in an area of thick flesh on tibialis anterior, depending on where you're needling it. So needling into areas of thick flesh also have a resonance with the earth phase spleen stomach. Mm-hmm. We know this because the chapter in the Ling Shu, chapter 7, all the different needle techniques, has a discussion of the five needle methods that match to the five tissues. In other words, the flesh, the sinew, the bone, the vessels, and the skin, as well as the Zhang organs. So needling into flesh treats disorders of flesh, as well as treats disorders of spleen stomach, right? So all of those different types of resonances, we can match stomach 36 to the digestive organs. So because there's resonance after resonance after resonance, and oh, by the way, it's on an earth phase channel, and it's an earth point on an earth phase channel, all of it gets us into the area of spleen stomach. So because there's so much resonance, there's so much deep connection, it's like, how can it not work? I mean, mm-hmm. When I look at a point like that, I think, how can it possibly not work for all these specific indications? So rather than looking at which is the best way to map something, my way of thinking is always, how can I really see if that's a very strong mapping or a strong resonance on multiple layers at the same time?
Hello, everyone. Anne Cecil Sturman here. A working knowledge of the 8 extraordinary channels from the unbroken oral tradition of acupuncture is valuable beyond words. The power of these channels is tremendous if the practitioner has well integrated diagnostic, theoretical, and practical skill. You'll be familiar with Dumai, the governor channel or the Sea of Yang, the primal reservoir of Yang, which ultimately finances all movement and growth. But this channel also governs the ability to self-determine. The psycho-emotional presentation of your patients can be matched to a classical activation of this channel, clearing impedance in the free flow of Yang Qi to body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to share with you the marvelous potency of the Du channel in a full-length live treatment video from the seminar I taught last year in Melbourne, Australia. It's at annececilsturman.com/sinews2024. Click on the Jump to Free Teaching button or see the link on my Instagram page at Anne Cecil Sturman. Thanks, Michael. Back to you.
Right. So you're looking at channels, you're looking at five element, you're looking at, you know, is it fleshy? Is it not fleshy? Is it sinewy? And you're also looking at all like the antique correspondences all at the same time.
Yes. And, you know, so one of the things that I tell when I teach a class in Dong's acupuncture, what I tell them is that for me, you know, personally, it may be heresy in certain circles to say this, but I don't really believe there's such a thing as, you know, Dong's acupuncture or Japanese acupuncture or Korean acupuncture or Chinese acupuncture, TCM acupuncture. To me, what all these different sort of systems approach to acupuncture are different ways of prioritizing treatment strategy. What do I start with? You know, what do I do first? What do I do second? Mm-hmm. What is my order of operations? What's the algorithm that I go through to affect a change in the diseased circulation of qi and blood in the area that I'm targeting, whether it's an organ, whether it's a part of the body? So for me, and what I tell my students is that they basically have to remember and put into practice all of the weird little details that we taught them in acupuncture points one or fundamentals one. They have to know all of the basic correspondences. They have to understand five phase. They have to understand all of the channels, where they go, what they do, and all of the five shoe points, the antique points. If they can do that, then they can use it flexibly. And so if they're a good TCM practitioner, they should be able to look at Dong's acupuncture and say, oh, I understand exactly what they're doing. May not be how I do it, but I understand what they're doing. And if you're a good practitioner of Dong's acupuncture, you should be able to look at the Japanese systems and say, oh, I totally understand what they're doing. May not be my preferred strategy, but I understand what they're trying to do. Right?
Because we're all looking at the same elephant.
Yeah, exactly. And I also tell people, and sometimes this gets me into trouble, and you know, maybe you'll get angry emails later about this, but I think there's I don't think there's such thing as even like classical acupuncture versus modern acupuncture, or this type of system versus this type of system. I think there's acupuncture done well and there's acupuncture done not so well. Acupuncture done well takes basically its source as the core theories that we discussed in books like The Neijing and The Nanjing, right? And because if we truly believe there's a channel system, if we truly believe in yin yang and five phases and not just pay lip service to it, then it must underlie everything we do with a needle, everything. And if we don't believe in it, then it's fine. Then it's a different discussion. But if we believe in it, then we have to be able to sort of take all that information into play in what we're doing. And so good acupuncture makes reference to all of these theories and all these ideas and uses it flexibly. And I don't care if it's a modern approach like scalp acupuncture or if it's an approach that's been around for a long time. It's either good because it works effectively in the clinic. And the reason I think it works effectively in the clinic is because it really sort of takes into consideration these core ideas of how the universe works and how our body works, if that makes sense.
You know, it totally makes sense. I'm thinking, and it's mostly because I'm kind of a lazy person. And over the years in my own study of acupuncture, I mean, yes, of course, I've read through the classic stuff, especially when I was in school, and you learn all the points and indications and those kinds of things. And then I find that I get into clinic and it's like, oh my God, now what do I do? And it's been helpful, at least in the beginning, to have some kind of shorthand or some kind of like, oh my God, where do I start? Well, I can start here. And again, because I'm a lazy person, I've often looked for shortcuts along the way. It's like, is there a way that I can like jumpstart and get really good at this without having to put all this minutia into play? And one of the things I've enjoyed about like the balance method, you know, the Dr. Tan stuff and the Dongshir to some extent, is it's allowed me to orient in a way where maybe I don't understand something, but if I can tune in to a certain aspect, oh, I've got an elbow problem, let me think about the knee. Oh, we've got a Xiaoyang issue. Okay, let me start with the Xiaoyang portion of the universe. How do I say this? It's like in the beginning, I thought, okay, I've got some shortcuts here that can help me. But what I found is there are no shortcuts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agree with both of those statements, actually. And, you know, when we're learning the material, you know, and I look at this, I look at this to some extent as a way of learning any kind of material. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, you know, I'm a graduate of Oberlin Conservatory. So I was one of my early, you know, before I got into Chinese medicine, I was trained as a classical musician.
Ah, so you've been involved in the classics for a long time then.
I have. And, you know, and I have to say, as where some people would not necessarily see the connection, in my opinion, between like learning classical medicine versus learning classical music is not so different, honestly, because the way we approach it is to some extent fairly similar. And one of the ways we approach it is that there's a constant spiraling of material deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're taking a new musician, we can take a new musician and teach them to play a simple melody or even a complicated piece. And they don't necessarily have to understand all of the deep theoretical underpinnings of what exactly the composer was doing in order to play it for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. But what separates even an advanced beginner from a professional performer is the professional performer gets so pickled in the music itself, where they not only can play it, but they understand to some extent exactly what's happening in terms of the melody, in terms of the harmony, in terms of whatever's going on every level. And what that does is it sort of jumps up their skill level significantly. So, you know, one of the beautiful things about Chinese medicine is that it really, in my opinion, taps into something so fundamental about what we are as humans, right? And how we interact with everything around us, how we interact with the cosmos, that even if you don't understand all of the nuances of what Stomach 36 does, it'll still do a hell of a lot of it for you regardless, right? So when learning the material with Dong's acupuncture or any acupuncture system, you don't have to understand all of the theoretical underpinnings just to get started. And that's fantastic. So people can start with learning just two or three points and start using them in their clinic. Once they start using them in the clinic and seeing that they are effective, getting more confidence with it, then later on, as time goes on, they can start exploring what are the deeper meanings, what are the deeper meanings of what we're doing, right? And this is a process that hopefully we all do, I think, for our whole lives. It's certainly a process that I do hopefully will do for my entire life. Yeah. I'm definitely not the best acupuncturist I know. I'm probably not even the second or third best acupuncturist I know. You know, I definitely don't know everything. But when I don't know something, I know that I don't necessarily know why it works, right? So, you know, I tell my students half in jest and half in not jest, when a teacher says to you, oh, it's empirical, right? It means one of a couple of things. One, it means your teacher doesn't understand why it works. Two, it means maybe they're just too lazy to tell you why it works. Or three, maybe for some reason they don't think you can understand it, or they just don't want to tell you for whatever reason. Now, none of those, you know, if they don't know why it doesn't work, that's not bad. But I don't fundamentally believe that anything is empirical. If something works, and again, if we believe in five phases, yin yang, channel systems, then there's a reason why it works clinically.
Yeah. I mean, there, how could it possibly work if there's no underlying reason for it to work?
Again, if we believe fundamentally in the theories of qi blood, of five phases, of yin yang, of channels, et cetera, then there has to be a reason why a point does what it does. There's no such thing as empirical. I certainly don't know what why every point does what it does. That, I don't think any person can ever 100% know everything.
Well, part of the joy of doing this work is discovering these things.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I'm the first person to tell someone, you know, I use this clinically. I know it does work. I may not understand why it works, but we can be comfortable in still using something without knowing 100% why. You know, Western doctors have done this for a long time.
Are you kidding? They do it all the time.
All the time. But as long as we're honest with saying, I don't know why it works, I know that it does work, we can still use it clinically. So beginners can still use points without understanding all of the details. But I do believe that over time, understanding all of the underpinnings helps us really sort of hone down, like, when is this point the absolute best, perhaps, as a possibility, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's the theory is good, it's important, but people still not be afraid to sort of just jump in with both feet and start using material.
Got it. I want to come back for a moment to the three taijis, the large, the medium, and the small. Are there any particular instances where you'd really want to be thinking, hey, I want to use the large taiji resonance for something? Or, you know, likewise, are there any particular situations where you think, ooh, that small taiji is going to give you more bang for your buck?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I think it depends on the part of the body you're working with, right? So certain parts of the body have a stronger resonance with one way of mapping over the other. So, I mean, something as simple as ear acupuncture. Ear acupuncture, I don't think really resonates with any other taiji except the small taiji. I mean, we could potentially argue that it does, but in actual application, maybe not so much. You know, I think for very simple musculoskeletal problems, relatively simple injury, for example, the large taiji is fairly effective and fairly effective quickly, right? And this is the basis of some of the teachings that Dr. Tan became. You know, I think we all owe him a great debt of gratitude in that he really, in a very vocal way, exposed acupuncturists in the United States to perhaps a different way of thinking beyond the sort of basic way we're taught in school, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I also went to a school that taught a variety of styles of acupuncture, but I remember going to a Dr. Tan class and it made sense to me, partly because I had a background that said, be open to lots of different things. And this was one that just made a lot of sense right from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, and to me, it made a lot of sense because one of my other sort of, before I studied Chinese medicine, I'd studied Asian martial arts from the time I was very young. You know, I think I started when I was 9 or 10. And the connections that we see in the large taiji, for example, that the large joints have a resonance with one another, right? The knees and the elbows go together. The hips and the shoulders go together. The wrists and the ankles go together. This is, even in, for example, in taiji, as in taiji, the martial art theory, what we talk about as the three external harmonies, right? So this is an important, this is a big deal in martial arts theory, and especially in terms of push hands or application of forms, right? So these ideas of how the body is sort of interconnected are not unique to Chinese medicine, but they're also there throughout the systems of sort of body cultivation that are also part of the larger tradition of health and wellness in Chinese history, right? So these were relationships that I had already heard about and that I was comfortable with, right? And I just never considered maybe we can apply these to acupuncture theory, right?
And then you run into the Dong style and you go, wow, there it is.
Here we go, right? Here it is. Exactly. And there's no reason since it works in one system, there's no reason it shouldn't work in another system.
Right. Because is this about cosmology or medicine?
Yes. Is it cosmology, masking as medicine, or is it medicine masked in cosmology? And the answer is yes. Exactly.
Okay. What about that middle taiji? Are there any particular instances where you'd want to start to think about that particular resonance?
The middle taiji is nothing more than jinging shujing he. It's the five antique points, right?
Okay.
And so those are at play all the time as well. And this teaching of the five antique points, to some extent, in my way of looking at acupuncture, is one of the fundamental teachings of what we're doing, right? Acupuncture doesn't add qi to the system. It doesn't nourish yin. It doesn't build blood. It doesn't, you know, move any. What acupuncture does,
right,
is
it's not an herb. It's not going to act like an herb.
Right. Right. And what it does is it gives the body of stimulus of some, in some way, shape, or form of saying, this is yin, this is yang. Move, consolidate, right? Go out, go in. So, or up or down, right? So, but what it's doing is it's normalizing circulation of qi and blood in the body. And to some extent, whether we see qi as something that is substantive and real as far as we can sort of understand reality, it doesn't really matter because it's a model that seems to work. And so I'm comfortable not knowing the fundamental nature of qi as long as the model for me as a physician works. And it does. It works very well. So what acupuncture is doing is it's giving a stimulus. The reason why the jing and the ing points do what they do is because they are distal, they're yang, they have a certain function and a certain message that it gives the body. The reason that the Jing River and the He uniting points do what they do is because they're proximal, they're yin. And so by virtue of them being proximal and yin, they give the body a slightly different message perhaps, right? And then since all of them are related to the five phases, we see that every channel has a connection to all of the five phases. So to me, the middle Taiji is the fundamental, most important way of looking at the dynamics of yin and yang in the body. Now, what it's also telling us is that all of the every condition in the body can be treated by these points from the knees and the elbows down, which is, again, the fundamental teaching of books like the Nanjing, right? Because that's really what the Nanjing talks about. So this, I mean, it's a much deeper theoretical discussion. This is the basis of why, for example, in Dong's acupuncture, we say that points like on the hands and the fingers treat more acute conditions, where points on the thigh, right, from the knee up to the trunk, treat more chronic conditions. Because what the middle Taiji teaches us is that we can look at the body as yin and yang and then use those body relationships to exploit a specific movement of qi and blood. And it's very vague, but, you know, it's probably the best we can do in a short discussion.
Mm-hmm. In recent years, the Siam acupuncture style has generated significant interest and a loyal and growing following. In the Siam approach, a precise diagnosis leads to a four-needle treatment to address the five element and six qi imbalances in the body. The four needles target the controlling and generating cycles. It's common using this method for the needle sensation to be stronger than in many other styles. Thus, the choice of needle becomes important. The Unico brand of needles lends itself to both strong and gentle techniques. These superior needles are made of uncoated Japanese surgical stainless steel and feature the best guide tube on the market with its unique beveled edge. Additionally, Unico needles have a tensile property that helps with freehanding needles into Jingwell points and allows you to more easily feel the arrival of qi. Blue Poppy is the exclusive importer and distributor of Unico needles. Use the code QI2024 to save 10% off Unico needles at www.bluepoppy.com. You'll be glad you did.
Okay. I want to get a little bit into some of the, we're talking about stomach 36. We all know about that. Without getting too simple, but just as a way of maybe enticing people to think about this Dong style and maybe take a little bit into their practice just from being able to, having spent a little time with this podcast. Can you give us a couple of points or combinations or areas of the body to think about that would be helpful in an everyday practice? Let's just say it's almost like a little mini lesson here, something that would give people an introduction both to being able to use this in their clinic, but also to demonstrate some of these principles that we've been talking about here so far.
Yeah, I think we can certainly. I mean, perhaps the most famous one of the most famous points in Dong's system is this point, Lingu, you know, miraculous bone or spirit bone. And it's the point given the number that they use in the Dong system is 22.05. And the numbering system is kind of crazy, but, you know, that's it's a bigger discussion. And it's
The numbering system we already have is kind of crazy, too. So yeah, it's just another numbering system.
They're all right. They're all exactly. It's just one that people aren't familiar with. So they're all kind of meaningless. They're all kind of crazy. It's even more meaningless to some extent in Dong's acupuncture. I mean, part of it is. But so Lingu is located on the hand, really just proximally to Hegu, to large intestine four, right? So we're basically on the back of the hand at the junction of the metacarpal bones in the space just proximal to large intestine four. You know, this is a point that has a it's very commonly used. It's something that people, since people are already used to needling large intestine four, they can incorporate this easily into their repertoire. It's just basically large intestine four needled slightly differently. Now, in Dong's acupuncture, this point has a number of different functions or a number of different uses. So certainly it's a major pain, it's a major pain relieving point. It has a very strong way of coursing the qi and blood. And if we look at the specific indications, we see it has a very strong resonance, especially with, for example, the head. It has a strong resonance with the lower abdomen, so it's used commonly to treat gynecological complaints. It also has a resonance with the low back, with the hips, and it also has a resonance with the lower part of the body, the foot. So, you know, let's say, for example, and the reason it has resonances with those areas is because of all the different ways we can divide the body up. So just looking at the large taiji, which is how we're mapping the arm to the leg or the arm to the trunk, the hand can be representative of the head. So if the hand goes to the head, the elbow goes to the navel region, right, to the height of the of Ren 8 and Ming Men on the back, of Du 4 on the back, and the shoulder goes down to the lower trunk. So the hand clearly has a resonance with the head. The hand and the foot also have a resonance. Right. So if we have problems in the head, we have problems in the feet, we can use a point on the hand.
Very now, common. We all do that anyway.
Very common, right. And this is very common and easy use of the point. The point itself, if we're looking at the area of the hand, we can invert the relationship. Why? Because if you think about it, hand treats head is using a distal part of the body. Hand is distal, which makes it yang, right? Basic theory. Head is superior. Is compared to the rest of the trunk, which also makes it yang, right? Basic theory. So using yang to treat yang, I tell my students, is not so interesting, not so sexy, not so fun, right? Because we know the Neijing set tells us that the superior acupuncturist leads yang from yin, yin from yang, treats right from left, left from right, right? This is in the early portion of the Suwen. So one of the basic things we understand in Chinese medicine is that yin and yang are mutually rooted. They can transform into one another, and so they have a strong resonance. So instead of now using the hand to treat the head, which is yang to treat yang, I can use the hand, which is yang, to treat the lower part of the trunk, which is yin, right? And so that's what we would call an inverted relationship or an inverted image of some sort. Mm-hmm. So the hand has a connection to the head, to the foot, to the lower back. So let's say we have a sciatic patient. And, you know, the typical sciatic patient, you know, a first year TCM student will think, okay, great. What channel is the site? Is it on the bladder channel? Is it on the gallbladder channel? And the patient comes in and they're a real patient. Unfortunately, they're not just a textbook. So the real patient says, oh, you know, I have pain in my low back and it's right in the middle and it goes right to the side of the back as well. And so it's, you know, it's my, like the quadratus lumborum area, it's right over the spine, and it sort of radiates into the back of my buttocks, and then it goes into my groin area, and then it sort of skips the upper leg, and it goes down into my foot, and it sort of goes down the side of my foot and the calf at the same time, and then it goes into my big toe, right? Because
yeah, love those.
Yeah, because if you're a practicing acupuncturist, you know that this is what a real sciatic patient looks like, right?
Yeah.
So let's break it down. So I have the low back, I have the hip, the hand can go to that area. I have the lower part of the, so it goes down to the toe, the foot, the hand can go to that area as well. Say the patient comes in, they have headache that day, you know, hand goes to the head as well. So we can use basically one point to treat, let's say 80% or 90% of that patient's problems right there. So the hand, Lingu, is on the large intestine channel. Whereas even though a point doesn't actually, we don't have a TCM point right in that exact location, it's along the large intestine channel. So we know the large intestine is the yang ming. That's an important piece to remember. And as an acupuncturist, I think it's sometimes more important to understand that the right in Chinese, they don't say the large intestine channel. They say the han yang ming.
Han yang ming, exactly. I mean, it gives you a lot of clues right there if you're doing it in Chinese.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so as an acupuncture teacher, I really wish we got our students in the habit of saying it's the han yang ming of the large intestine, right? So yes. That they remember all of that. So right away, we know that the han yang ming can treat the area of the big toe, right? There's a connection between the yang ming and the zhui yin, right? So the yang ming large intestine can treat the zhui yin liver, which is the big toe. This is one of the reasons why the four gates are such a good point combination, right? When we're looking at traditional point combinations, it's important to look not only at what the points do as if they were herbs, which is how we teach the four gates, but also the channel connections and resonances. So here we have the large intestine and the liver have a strong resonance. We also know from the 10 stems that the yin wood stem, right? That's the yi stem. Jia is yang wood, yi is yin wood. And the gung stem, which is the yang metal stem, right? So stem number 2 and stem number 7 also have a resonance, right? So there's a reason
now,
why.
Now, this is where your classical music training really comes in, doesn't it?
Well, I think so, right? This is looking at all of the subtle connections that may be present there. So here we have a resonance not only from hand to foot, from the yang ming to the zhui yin, but also from the yang metal specifically to the yin wood. So there's no way that hand point can't treat that area of the foot. Right. When we're looking at moving into the groin, if that were still looking at the sciatica patient, the groin can be either stomach channel, liver channel, yang ming large intestine goes to yang ming stomach, yang ming large intestine can still go to zhui yin liver. Right. So we're covered there. On the back, with looking at the spine in particular, the spine is the dumai, but it's also the internal branch of the kidney channel. Right, so when we're looking at channels, we have to memorize not only the external branches, but also where they go internally. So the large intestine and the kidney channel are opposite one another in the timing of the day. Right, so large intestine channel is 5 to 7 in the morning. Kidney channel is in the evening, opposite that time. Right, and so those channels also have a connection. I think it's a travesty that when we learn this cycle of the what time goes with each channel, we just assume that automatically, oh, if it's midnight, it's a gallbladder channel problem. And I think that's completely the wrong way to understand it. And I can back that up with quotes from the Suwen and the Ling Shu to prove my point. We can have that conversation later. In my opinion, the time of the day is more important for us to understand different yin-yang connections of the different channels. So the large intestine channel by itself has a connection to kidney channel, which is the spine. So we can go from Lingu to the spine.
Via the clock opposite.
Via the clock opposites, right. Mm-hmm. Now the Lingu, when I know that there are different ways of needling Lingu, my preference of needling Lingu is to point it towards the area of the thenar eminence, right? So we're pointing it down towards roughly large intestine 10 vicinity. I'm sorry, to lung 10 vicinity, right? Mm-hmm. So we're connecting essentially the large intestine channel and the lung channel.
With the lung channel, yeah.
With one needle, right. So this is what we call a through-and-through needle technique. And just in case your listeners, if they're new to that idea, it doesn't mean the needle comes out the other side, but the needle tip is going to the space of where the channel is because it's not right on the skin, it's in the tissue. So one needle, we connect large intestine to lung channel. Now the lung tie-in has a connection to the bladder tai yang, which means that point can also get us into the vicinity of like quadratus lumborum. That makes sense?
Totally makes sense.
And so the only channel we haven't covered basically is if there's any gallbladder channel distribution, which we can cover by adding in maybe one other point on the hand or on the arm or something like that. So with one point, we can have all these different types of resonances. Then even beyond that, for example, when we feel the pulse, for me, Lingu as a point has a particularly good effect at coursing qi and blood. We know it's on the Yangming channel, which is full of qi and blood. When the pulse comes back as particularly wiry, then in my view, this is where sometimes, in my opinion, the just doing the image may get us there most of the time, but not as much as we'd like. Because I've had lots of students come back and say, oh, Lingu didn't work when I had a sciatica. And I always ask them, what's the pulse like? What's the rest of the presentation like? If the patient has a real sort of strong kidney deficiency pattern, right? If the pulse is deep and thready, in my opinion, Lingu is not the first point to choose. Lingu, in my opinion, is the first point to choose when we have this very hard, wiry pulse, which can sometimes be more of an acute condition. It can be chronic in other certain types of presentations. But the wiry pulse, if we're looking at pulse diagnosis, one of the pulse diagnosis approaches that I really like is the sort of what I call the archetypal pulses of the five phases, which are described as the pulses of the five seasons, right? Mm-hmm. So wiry pulse is the archetypal pulse of spring, of liver, of wood phase. Again, the relationship then is Lingu is on the large intestine channel. The large intestine yang metal goes to the yin wood. Large intestine also as a metal channel is also in a control cycle relationship with wood. So if the pulse is primarily giving me a message of wood as the main movement of the five phases in the body somehow,
then this point would really knock it out of the park.
Exactly. Because this point, and this is why precisely the four gates does what it does, right? Not only because of the yang metal to yin wood, but also because there's a five phase control cycle relationship, right? So we can do needle technique on the large intestine channel specifically to course, in other words, to drain the stasis in wood. Make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Now, and I'm sure you could go on with more of this. You mentioned that if they've got this sort of deep, thready kidney pulse, kidney deficiency pulse.
Yes.
What would you think about then? Where would you start with that?
Well, then we have to choose a point that has a resonance somehow with the kidney, right? And so there are a set of points on the side of the hand in Dongzhi acupuncture called the wrist flow, the Wanshun points. They're located in the vicinity, pretty much overlapping the area of small intestine 3, and then a little further down at the – so there's one basically at the head and the base of the fifth metacarpal bone, right? Mm-hmm. So there, it's not quite all the way at small intestine 4. It's a little closer into small intestine 3, but they're in that general vicinity. It's called wrist flow. These points in Dongzhi acupuncture have an association with the kidney. In particular, we know that they're on the Taiyang channel, which means they have an association with the Taiyang bladder, which brings us very clearly into that water.
Right, into the Shaoyang kidney.
Absolutely. And then we know that small intestine 3, right? Small intestine 3 is a shoestring point. The shoestring point treats pain, it treats conditions of pain and heaviness in the channel. And then we have to ask ourselves, even in conventional acupuncture, what's the relationship of small intestine 3? What else does that we know about that point? So small intestine 3 is the shoestring points on the yang channels are wood points. Small intestine channel by itself, even though in Dongzhi acupuncture, this area of the body, that area of the hand is associated with the kidney. In regular Chinese medicine, regular channel theory, small intestine channel is a fire channel. So the relationship between wood point and fire channel means that small intestine 3, since wood is the mother of fire, small intestine 3 is the supplementation point of the small intestine channel. So we know that the fundamental nature of small intestine 3, even in classical, conventional, whatever you want to call regular 12-channel system acupuncture, the fundamental nature of small intestine 3 is as a point that has a supplementing effect on the channel. More so than, say, you know, the area of Lingu.
Right. So it would be better point for a deficient condition.
Exactly. Right. So that area of the hand we would potentially look at, which is why we see indications in the traditional Dong lineage literature of things like pain in the body accompanied by fatigue, right? So we would diagnose this as like a kidney yang insufficiency or kidney insufficiency in general, because, you know, yang or yin, I don't know how comfortable I am with that, with only using acupuncture, not bringing in herbs or moxa or something else, right? Mm-hmm. But if there's a kidney insufficiency, the kidney's not consolidating, at the same time there's pain, then we can use points like that. And then after that, we have to go down to the legs, which have a more of a sort of like a stabilizing, consolidating effect, because legs compared to arms are more yin. The nature of yin is to hold and consolidate, which is why all of the in Dong's acupuncture, all of the important points for treating insufficiency of the five zong organs are on the legs.
This is the polar opposite of a system of shortcuts.
Yes, but you can, it is, but students can still learn, you know, pulse wiry, excess condition, here are the images, lingu. You know, pulse deep and weak, just go to this point group. So we can start with really sort of like, you know, it's like when I teach classes, even if we spend days and days learning points, I usually say, okay, these are maybe the top 30 heavy hitters that you should start using in your clinic. Even if you don't understand why you're using them, figure out what their main indications are and start using them in those patients and see what you can do.
You know, that makes so much sense, because even if we don't completely understand it, if we can get it to work, it'll keep us going.
That's right.
It'll keep our patients going. And eventually, the more we use things and the more we think about things in general, the more the points begin to speak to us in a certain way. And these associations are easier to make.
They do. Absolutely. And these, it's like when I see a point, when I see a patient, all these associations are going through my head basically constantly. But I didn't start there, right? We start from a place of just, you know, there was benefit to just memorize it first. And that's another way that classical music training and classical medicine training was similar at the beginning. You know, when I remember when I was before I went to Chinese medicine professionally, I worked for a number of years as a high school music teacher, and I taught instrumental music. That was my background. And I remember someone coming up to me one day and saying, "Oh, that must be such a creative job." And I thought to myself for a second. I said to them, "Actually, no, it's not, because I'm an instrumental music teacher," which means for the first 10 years, if they want to be serious musicians, they have to do it exactly the way I say it. They don't have any say in how they do it.
That's right. It's technical school here.
Exactly. I mean, you can only learn, there's only one, there's maybe a couple, but there's really only one set of fingerings for, you know, a flute without much variation. And until they can do it, you know, when I was conservatory, I used to sit in a dark practice room and do my scales an hour or two at a time. Just over and over and over, and then arpeggios over and over and over. Because until you have it in your fingers, you can't really make art with it, right? So we have to start with some sort of basic memorization of key facts, key information. It's the same thing with acupuncture. So we have to start with, you know, what are the 30 main points? That's why something like the Ma Dan Yang, 12 star, heavenly star points, was such a great thing, right? Here we are. Okay, these are 12 points that treat lots and lots of conditions. Just memorize this and you got a good place to start.
I'm not familiar with those points. Where did that come from?
The Ma Dan Yang heavenly star points. He was they're referenced in, even in Deadman they have them. They're a list of 12 essential points. Ma Dan Yang was a famous Taoist. I'm gonna get the dynasty wrong, so I'm not even gonna say it. But you know, he had a list of 12 key points that were really good for a wide range, and they're heavy hitters, right? So like points like gallbladder 30 was one of the points. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's like certain points treat a wide range of conditions. These are the ones you start with.
You know, I think this is such an important thing that you just say, is that these points, we start with them. We don't end with them.
Right. Absolutely.
They get us started. In fact, they give us a little bit of speed. Like when you first get on a bicycle, you need a little oomph to catch your balance. These kind of points will get us going, and then they can open up a tremendous rabbit hole if we're paying attention.
Absolutely. And, you know, and part of me wishes that in conventional acupuncture teaching, we didn't just say, okay, here's the stomach channel, and here's every single point on the stomach channel. Perhaps it would be better if we said in points one, we're going to do all the channels, but learn maybe the top 4 or 5 points in each channel and just start with that. And then in points two, we're going to go back through all the channels and fill in the blanks perhaps a little bit better.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. I'm thinking, well, as we were talking earlier, we can talk about the lung channel, or we can talk about the hand Tai Yin.
Yes.
And if you're thinking about hand Tai Yin, you're already making all kinds of other associations.
Well, I mean, and I think that even the more important part of that is, even if the student doesn't remember all the associations, if they're memorizing it as the hand Tai Yin channel, then 6 months after that, they'll say, oh, that's an important connection. And then a year later, they'll be like, oh, that's another important connection. Mm-hmm. But if they never memorize it as the hand Tai Yin channel, then they'll never make those connections.
That's right, because that pathway is just not there.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Great. Henry, I'm just looking at the time here. I can't believe it has flown by so quickly. I've got so much more I'd actually like to talk to you about. So maybe we can do a part two somewhere down the road.
Yeah, that's fine. I'd be more than happy to it. Happy to do it. Yeah.
But before we close it down, is there any final closing remarks or things that you'd like our listeners to think about?
For me, the most important lesson of all of this really is this what we sort of started talking about, which is this idea of resonance, right? You know, in Chinese, they call it the gan ying, right? So this is like how we sort of have this ongoing dialogue with, in the big scheme of things, it's how our body has this ongoing dialogue with the natural environment, right? How our spleen has an ongoing dialogue with the different channels and the other organs, right? And so it's a matter of eventually learning all of those and being sensitized, to all of those connections that are going on all the time. And, you know, this for me is my personal koan, I guess, right? It's like, how can I look at this in everything that's going on? Not only in my acupuncture, not only in my Tai Chi, my martial arts practice or my Qigong practice, but how is it happening even in how I relate to other people, in society, everything. It's like all these different ways of looking at resonance. And so Chinese medicine to me is, I mean, it's a great profession and it supports me well. And I think I help lots of people and that makes their lives better. But it's also this way of exploring the sort of thoroughgoing interconnectedness of all things, right? It's another medium of exploring that. And to some extent, that biggest piece of the philosophy is what keeps me interested in doing it year after year after year. I mean, because if you're practicing clinician, you know it gets tedious, right? I saw patients for 12 hours in the clinic yesterday, back to back to back to back to back. And if you don't have something that sort of lights that fire underneath you, that's when the burnout happens. But if you have that fire that's there, that sort of constant sense of inquiry, then, you know, I've been in practice for 18 years now, and I've done this kind of schedule for most of that time. And it's still every day I go in, there's very rarely a day where I go into the office and think I'd rather be somewhere else. And partly it's because of that sort of those deeper philosophical questions are sort of underpin everything that I do. And that's good. I think it's a good way to sort of think about things.
Yeah. Going into clinic and life every day with a constant state of inquiry.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Lovely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Henry, thank you so much for your time today. I really have enjoyed this conversation and look forward to another one.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks as always for listening. If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.